Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen. Our top story today is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Christina Laurie about the City of Kingston's grade on the Kingston Chamber of Commerce report card.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca.
The Kingston Chamber of Commerce has released their Kingston City Council report card for the third quarter of 2023. The report card is a document that was just launched this year and provides a summary of business-related decisions which come before council throughout each quarter. Each decision made by council is marked with one of three colors depending on its impact on Kingston's local businesses. Green marks positive outcomes, yellow marks potential concerns, and red marks negative outcomes. This most recent report card covers July, August, and September of 2023. Only five business-related motions came before council, in comparison to 13 in their second report. Of those motions, two were marked green, two were marked yellow, and one was marked red. The overall rating for the quarter was yellow. The one red decision was council voting in favor of spending $100,000 to study the idea of a vacant home tax. Explaining the red ranking, the report argues, quote, "At a time when vacancy rates are at record lows in Kingston and where home ownership costs are increasing steadily due to higher interest, material costs, and labor costs, this does not seem like a wise use of resources and time," which, again, could serve to simply penalize landlords who have a portfolio that includes vacant properties, end quote. Two major concerns pointed out in the summary of the report were items that were not discussed by council during the quarter. For the first issue, the report states, quote, "One issue that continues to concern us, yet has seemingly not received significant attention at council in recent months, is the family doctor shortage. It has been many months since there was an update on the proposed clinic at the former St. Mary's of the Lake Hospital, and it's unclear if plans are in the works should the Ontario Ministry of Health reject these plans," end quote. The second issue they wish to see discussed by council in the coming months is the city's new patio bylaws, set to be implemented in spring of 2024. Included in the proposed changes, the city will no longer allow wooden tables on patios, restrict the type of umbrellas restaurants can have on their patios, and require them to close by 11 p.m. The chamber hopes to see large changes made to these bylaws before their implementation. After the next few months, the chamber will release their final 2023 report and wrap up their first year of report cards.
Thank you, Chris. Now over to CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell with a story from LJI reporter Owen Fullerton about the ratification of a collective bargaining agreement for Ontario elementary school teachers.
Thank you, Dinah. Elementary school teachers in Ontario will avoid any kind of strike action for at least the next 3 years, as members of the Elementary Teachers Federation of Ontario, or ETFO, voted overwhelmingly to accept a tentative deal with the Ontario government. Permanent and occasional teacher members voted 90% in favor of accepting the agreement that was reached with the Ontario Public School Boards Association, OPSBA, and the provincial government in November. In a statement from ETFO, President Karen Brown says, "Despite the particularly difficult bargaining process, members dug in and have a fair deal because of it." Brown stated that ETFO members stood firm in the face of cuts, pressed for improvements to working and learning conditions, and won. Brown made reference to the Ford government's use of the notwithstanding clause last fall when she noted that the agreement was, quote, "proof that the legal bargaining process works when it's allowed to unfold as intended." Prior to ratification, members had voted 95% in favor of a strike mandate. ETFO highlighted funding for over 400 new specialist teaching positions in 2024-25 and continued funding to maintain the positions for at least another two school years to follow. Preservation of the Support for Student Fund was also highlighted, in addition to new measures being implemented in schools to help address violence. Without a new collective agreement, over 83,000 education and support staff could have participated in labor action. Ontario's Minister of Education, Stephen Lecce, used the opportunity of announcing the deal's ratification to push Catholic and French education unions to finalize their own deal with the province. The deal will still need to be ratified at the local level by the district school board. ETFO Limestone will work with the Limestone District School Board to negotiate a collective agreement, and a spokesperson for the Limestone District School Board said local bargaining is progressing and will continue into the new year. And now over to Dinah Jansen with a story about a potential name change for the Strathcona Paper Center from local journalism initiative reporter for the Kingstonist, Michelle Dory Forestell.
Thank you, Jesse. The Strathcona Paper Center may be renamed in 2024. At its regular meeting on Tuesday, December 19th, the Council of the Town of Greater Napanee received information on a recreation center naming rights draft agreement. After a brief discussion, Council directed town staff to reissue a request for proposals for the naming rights with a minimum bid of $30,000 per year. On April 10, 2003, the town signed a facility naming rights agreement with Roman Corporation Limited for the naming of the recreation center located at 16 McPherson Drive in Napanee, Strathcona Paper Center. Strathcona Paper, a division of Roman Corporation Limited, has been making recycled paperboard on the banks of the Napanee River since the early 20th century. According to the report by Annie Mannion and Brant Zatterberg of Community and Corporate Services for the Town of Greater Napanee, the term of the agreement was 10 years and commenced on September 1, 2004. The agreement was renewed for another decade in September 2014. The value of the naming rights has been $20,000 per year since 2004. The terms of the current naming rights agreement is set to expire on August 31, 2024. According to the report, staff have identified the need for an agreement to clearly define how proposals for naming rights are received, evaluated, and awarded. The goal of the agreement and draft donations and sponsorship policy is to ensure that no person receives an unfair advantage in accessing sponsorship opportunities in public facilities, that the town can maximize alternative revenue sources in support of programs and facilities, that all donations and advertising comply with applicable laws and regulations, that the town can differentiate between charitable donations and sponsorships that will provide a net positive to the community over the life of the project, and that the town considers all future costs and liabilities. Some advantages to obtaining the naming rights are described in the draft agreement. For example, the recreation center is located adjacent to nationally branded hotels and restaurants. Many different user groups, including minor hockey, junior hockey, skating clubs, soccer teams, seniors groups, and more, attend the arena throughout the year, bringing considerable marketing exposure and a variety of events throughout the year which have attracted broad audiences. In each of the last 2 years, foot traffic at the SPC has been estimated at over 150,000 visitors, and with the center being adjacent to Highway 401, the average daytime vehicle traffic is approximately 40,000, according to 2016 statistics. Naming proposals will be received at the front reception desk until 1 p.m. on March 1st, 2024. Thank you to Michelle Dory Forestell of the Kingstonist for that story. And now back to Jesse Bell with two regional stories from LGI reporters Philip Blancher of the Morrisburg Leader on traffic metrics on the St. Lawrence Seaway and Keith Dempsey of the Brockville Recorder and Times on Gananoque Mayor John Beddoes' commitment to increase accessibility in the community.
Thank you, Dinah. Monthly traffic on the St. Lawrence Seaway increased in the final month of 2023. After seeing traffic lower than 2022's numbers for the first half of the shipping season, year-to-month traffic through to the end of November was up 3.36% overall, with grain, dry bulk, and coal shipments leading this traffic rebound. The number of ships and vessels sailing the Seaway remains below last year's numbers, with a 2.28% decrease year-to-date. The surge in grain traffic is due to improved harvest yields in Western Canada and the need for more exports due to the Russo-Ukrainian War and supply chain disruptions. Coal shipment increases are tied to increased steel production in the United States. The shipping statistics include a one-week period in the fall where the Seaway was idle due to labor action. General cargo was down 17% from 2022. Liquid bulk shipments, oil, additives, and the like were down 1% from 2022, while iron ore was down just a shade under 1%. With exception to general cargo and dry bulk shipping, all traffic types and overall traffic is in a downward trend since 2019. Overall traffic on the St. Lawrence Seaway is down 5% since 2019, as are vessel transits. Compared to 2019, there were 322 fewer ships using the international waterway. A 2022 consultation by Transport Canada found that labor staffing issues and increased competition from other transportation sectors, such as rail and highway, were factors in the overall decrease on the Seaway. The Seaway is scheduled to close 5 days later than it did in 2022, due to mild weather conditions. The last ships for the 2023 shipping season passed through the navigational region between Cape Vincent, New York and St. Lambert, Quebec on January 5th, 2024. In other local news, Gananoque Mayor John Beddoes has made the expansion of accessibility features on electric vehicle charging stations a key goal for 2024. Beddoes' interest in the issue was spurred by a personal experience he had at the local Flow/Tesla charging station in Gananoque. Beddoes noted that there weren't any wide parking spaces and that the charging port for the vehicles were located behind curbs. After conducting his own research, Beddoes stated that he, quote, couldn't find a single picture of a Tesla charging station that was accessible. Beddoes continued and stressed that proper access to these charging stations was about equitable access to an essential service. According to ChargeHub.com, which lists information for EV charging stations provincially and nationally, there are about 20 charging stations in Gananoque. Beddoes stated that he would bring a motion at the next council meeting to start the process of making these charging stations more accessible. Beddoes wants all future charging stations built in Gananoque to include a, quote, accessible component to ensure that the town can deliver equity of access to all those who require it.
Thank you so much, Jesse. And now up next, we have a segment from CJAI, Amherst Island Radio's local journalism initiative reporter, Ted Evans, with a report on public concerns over a proposed housing development in Odessa.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca. Loyalist Township is considering an official plan amendment and zoning bylaw amendment for the development of three-story stacked row dwelling condominiums in Odessa, consisting of 15 units in each building, for a total of 45 units. Public meetings on October 11th, 2022 and December 11th this year have seen a number of residents come forward with concerns. Primary concerns from the public were safety issues, traffic concerns, incompatibility, aged water and sewer infrastructure, proximity to the 401, parking capacity, on-street parking, emergency services access, storm drainage, and blasting considerations. Since the meeting last year, amendments have been made to the applications to address technical review comments and public feedback. The revised applications and supporting material are currently under technical review. A recommendation report will be brought forward once the review is completed and comments can be addressed from agencies, staff, and the public. Mark Tao, a registered official planner with Arcadis, explains how even though the group is applying for variances, the project's plan is consistent with the township's and county's official plan.
Official plan amendments are permitted under the Planning Act, so official plans of the municipalities can be amended. In order for them to be amended, they have to be consistent with the intent of the official plan. So if you're changing a land use designation, for example, that would require an official plan amendment, but it has to meet the policies of the official plan to allow a change to the land use designation. So in this case, the amendment is to allow a change from low density residential to medium density residential. And there are specific tests in the official plan about how or why such an amendment to the designation can take place. So in evaluating the official plan amendment, you would look at what are the policy tests in the official plan as to where new medium density residential can be permitted. And if those tests are met, then you can say that the intent of the official plan is satisfied.
Loyalist Township's official plan notes that medium density projects are not to draw traffic through low density areas. Tao described how the group amended their original plans for the buildings and described how they're working on the issue of higher traffic.
In my mind, that's the biggest single challenge on this site is access and what's the appropriate amount of development. I think that's why there were some units lopped off from the first iteration and some additional traffic work done to make sure that it wouldn't be problematic. Looking at, you know, how do municipalities fit in a bit more density into their built up areas, providing gentle density. So trying to insert medium density or a bit higher density within existing built-up areas. And so how do you do that in a way that's still compatible and that doesn't cause issues? I think the good thing about this site is that it is on the edge of, you know, it kind of forms the edge of this neighborhood, and it's in a larger lot between housing and Highway 401 and a county road. I think if access were directly to County Road 6, that would have been better. So I think the challenge here is what's an appropriate amount of development that doesn't create traffic issues or still can function given, you know, pedestrian activity in the area.
Tao discussed the peak amount of traffic mentioned in the traffic study report.
One of the things the traffic consultant looked at, which is in the traffic study, is, you know, what's the peak amount of traffic coming and going from a site? Like, what's the amount of impact the neighborhood would feel morning and evening commute times? And so in the morning, the peak amount of traffic leaving the site between, you know, I think it's 8 and 9, five vehicles entering the site in the morning commute, and then 17 leaving, and then 15 inbound. So coming back in the peak hour, say between 4 and 5, and 11 going out. So that's not to say there's not more coming and going other times of the day, or people don't leave earlier for shift work or come in later, but that's the kind of worst hour of the morning commute and the evening commute coming in. So that's about, if you look at 22 during the morning, that's about one additional car every 2.5 minutes coming on William Street. And in the evening, just probably 2.5 vehicles again per 5 minute interval coming in and out. So I think the amount of traffic that's going to come in and out, it will increase, but I think that amount of traffic on the local road has been demonstrated, at least technically through the studies, to show that it's not going to result in you know, traffic issues at the intersection or generate a lot more traffic in the neighborhood that it would be a problem.
Cassell Prince, registered professional engineer with McIntosh Perry, explains findings from the traffic study.
The way the traffic is generated is based on an accepted industry standard for specific land uses. So based on the type of residential that is going to be built, there is an accepted type of generation for that land use. In addition to that, the study itself has been peer-reviewed externally to verify the analysis that has been provided. And that peer review has assessed that the trip generation used for the site is deemed appropriate, and the findings have shown that the traffic on the network can further accept any traffic generated by the site.
The plan notes the buildings only include external staircases for the second and third floors. Tao describes the level of accessibility in the proposed buildings and the difference from floor to floor.
This is the stack townhouse design is a form, unless the grading allows, is a form that does require stairs for access up or down. So the units wouldn't have that element of accessibility to them in terms of an at-grade entrance. But the basement unit, for example, is all on one grade. So aside from navigating the stairs to that unit, for example, it is otherwise accessible within the unit.
Tao describes the parking situation for the proposed buildings and notes how the developer came upon the decision.
In traditional, you know, single detached or even semi or townhouse dwellings, especially in Lewis Township, so I'll give you a bit of background. So Arcadis IBI is the consultant planner for Napanee. So we review a lot of applications for the town. Similar issues, you know, there is no transit system, not necessarily, you know, naturally very walkable in terms of getting to grocery stores without the use of a car. So I think that's why the applicant increased the parking ratio from the first submission to the second one to try to address that. That being said, having two parking spaces per unit, based on the developer's experience for this type of housing, like the stacked townhouses, they did think it would be more than adequate because their experience with this type of housing, and they've done other similar developments to this, is that it's rare for all the units to have two vehicles. And so there would be some allowance for visitor parking. This is also a condo development as well. So each of the spaces are going to be specifically assigned to each of the units.
Residents of William Street in Odessa voiced their concerns.
It would put a lot of stress on the infrastructure. We probably wouldn't have enough water pressure to flush your toilets or brush your teeth.
There is no consideration for visitor parking and a third car parking, which will cause safety hazards because they'll be parking on the street.
Just because we're on the edge of Odessa, I heard them say that, that doesn't mean we don't count. We still pay our tax. I pay over $4,000 a year in property taxes.
In the event of an emergency or the fire trucks and ambulances would have difficulty entering and exiting due to traffic on the street and no through lot.
You know, we're not big city. We're a small area. We're a rural area, and we don't need to have all that crammed in there.
There's vandalism in the new subdivision at the park. I have three young children. I don't want that.
I moved here 20 years ago, picked my house specifically for nice, quiet, away from all the crap that I don't want. I love this area, and I don't want it to change.
We've been trying to sell our house for 2 years because of this project.
The new proposed development does not address the fact that William Street was not set up to handle that kind of traffic. It is already difficult at times, and when the 401 closes, added traffic will congest the area even more. Everyone knows that when the 401 closes, you can't get home.
Your ability to see down the street to pull out on Highway 2 is very, very limited. It's going to be that much worse when you get traffic backup and people are getting anxious. People are turning around to go out Factory Street or an alternate route. It's just going to be mayhem.
I'm concerned for the safety of my children with the amount of traffic that will be on that street. They ride up and down that street on their bikes, on their skateboards, they walk. The addition of this building or buildings, I don't feel that my street will be safe for them to play. I chose my home for a reason. I chose my home because it is in a quiet residential neighborhood where they could play.
Four, five, six houses, fine. I mean, some people might not like that, but that's doable. But this amount of, this is insanity, in my personal opinion.
The applications, submitted by Brookland Fine Homes Limited, were received by council and will be seen again once comments from the township departments, agencies, and public have been addressed. For CJAI and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Coming up next, a piece by CJPE's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Brenda Little about a Prince Edward County Council meeting being postponed due to illness.
Hi, I'm Craig Foster, Local Journalism Initiative reporter and news director at CJPE 99.3 County FM in beautiful Prince Edward County. Coming are some of the top stories from PEC. You can hear County FM news 5 days a week, six times a day on 99.3 County FM, the voice of the county, or stream us at 99.3countyfm.ca.
In the wake of the Prince Edward County 2024 budget talks from 2 weeks ago, illnesses struck members of the council, resulting in the cancellation of the December 19th council meeting. The big issue hanging in the air is the awarding of the tender for the multi-million-dollar Wellington Trunk Line. Council pressed pause at the November 28th meeting after numerous individuals and grassroots groups pleaded with council to put the brakes on and investigate other options. The impact on taxpayers would be significant, and with current high interest rates, the fear is the developer may back out. A tender has been chosen, and the issue will be the hot topic for the next meeting, January 9th, as well as staff report on the Trey Resort application and the reconsideration of the U-Ride subsidy. At the meeting of November 28th, Council chose not to renew the U-Ride funding of $30,000, which is a living wage subsidy for the drivers. U-Ride started operations in the county July 2022 and has filled the gaps in the transportation needs in and around the area, especially during the height of tourism season in the summer. There are only two taxi companies operating in the county, and Rick Marshall, owner of the Taxi Guy, told Picton Gazette there is more business than they can handle during the summer and that they turn away about 50% of the calls. Council learned that U-Ride will pick up customers from the far reaches of the county day or night, where the taxi companies have a more limited range and hours of operation. The subsidy will be reintroduced by Councillor Hirsch at the January 9th meeting. For the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Brenda Little.
And thank you to the team over at CJPE County FM in Picton. Up next, we have a story from LJI reporter Jeff Gard from CFWN in Cobourg about the improvement of parking facilities at the Five Counties Children's Center.
The Ontario government and the Ontario Trillium Foundation announced $396,100 in new funding Friday for the Five Counties Children's Center in Cobourg. Five Counties CEO Scott Pepin said a capital grant of $255,100 from the Ministry of Children, Community and Social Services will revamp and expand their parking lot to accommodate more families accessing their services and its neighboring early on site. Pepin said an additional $141,000 from the Ontario Trillium Foundation will support the center's Northumberland Backyard Project.
Their end result will be a fully accessible, culturally responsive, nature-based play space that boosts outdoor treatment sessions, reduces wait lists, and helps children and families enjoy accessible play. Once completed, the backyard will include an accessible playground, sensory play equipment, a garden area, a gazebo, a stage and track for wheelchairs, bikes, and other mobility devices.
Initial grading, drainage, landscaping, and fencing was completed during the summer and fall, and with the new funding, the project is expected to be completed in 2024. Five Counties Children's Center provides speech, physio, and occupational therapies, as well as other treatment services for children and youth from birth to age 18 in Northumberland, Peterborough, Kawartha Lakes, and Halliburton. This past year, Five Counties has served more than 6,200 children and youth, including 2,000 in Northumberland County. I'm Jeff Gard, reporting for Northumberland, 89.7 FM.
And thank you, Jeff. Now back over to CFRC's own Jesse Bell for the Environment Canada Weather Report and CFRC's Concert and Community Events Calendar.
Thank you, Dinah. We will begin with the Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region. Thursday, January 4th, we saw a high of negative 6 degrees Celsius with snow throughout the day. Overnight, it's going to get even colder, dropping to a bone-chilling negative 12 degrees. Things will warm up a touch during the day Friday on January 5th with a high of negative 1, mix of sun and cloud, but it's going to be negative 8 overnight. Saturday, January 6th, is going to be cloudy and cold, high of negative 4 with a chance of snow, about 30% as of right now. Overnight with a high of negative 8, it's going to reach a high of negative 3 on Sunday, January 7th, but the snow will continue to fall all the way into the evening. On Monday, January 8th, no snow but a mix of sun and cloud throughout the day. However, the high is only negative 3 degrees. That concludes your Environment Canada Weather Report for the week. Here is the CFRC Concert and Events Calendar for the week. On Friday, January 5th, check out the Kingston Frontenacs as they host the Mississauga Steelheads. Puck drop is scheduled for 7 p.m. at the Leon Center. On Wednesday, January 10th, check out the Eagles Tribute Band, Hotel California, at the Kingston Grand Theater. The show is scheduled to begin at 7:30 p.m. And on Friday, January 12th, the Kingston Frontenacs will be in action again against their hated rivals, the Oshawa Generals. Puck drop scheduled for 7 p.m.
Thank you so much, Jesse, and thank you to our listeners and local sponsors for assistance in helping us raise over $13,000 during CFRC's annual fundraising campaign. You can still support station operations and our local news programming by making a gift via CFRC.ca. Don't forget to subscribe to the Corridor podcast on Spotify and Apple Music, and you can keep up with the latest in CFRC programming and initiatives by following us on our new Instagram and Facebook pages at CFRC Music. From all of us at CFRC 101.9 FM, thank you for tuning into The Corridor, and we wish you the very best for a great new year. Thank you for tuning into The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. We'll see you next time. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.